This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, Hawaii Talks. I'm Catherine Cruz. In Hawaiian history, this year commemorates 200 years since the Battle of Kuamo'o and the end of the Kapu system. On the bicentennial of this seismic change in Hawaiian law, the School of Hawaiian Knowledge, Hawaii Nui Akea, is marking the occasion with a weekend event entitled Kahulina Au, The Changing Time. As the school marks the event, it puts in context current issues facing Native Hawaiians. John Osorio, the school's dean, spoke with The Conversation's Harrison Patino.
We are having a fundraiser performance tribute to the chiefs, the Ali'i Nui of 1819, and we're celebrating or commemorating this event that took place 200 years ago called Kahuliau. Kahuliau means the changing time, and we are commemorating this with a half dozen hula halau. We're going to have all of these dancers, each of them providing mele and hula, that is, songs and dances that were originally composed for the high chiefs Keopuolani, Liholiho, Kahumanu, the principals, the people who were principally involved in the event that we know of as the Ainoa.
So I assume for an event this big, talking about what you're most looking forward to might be like picking between your favorite child. Is there something you're particularly looking forward to for this event?
Well, one of the things that I'm looking forward to is the opportunity for Hawaiians to come together to see in one place these mele and hula that that really do belong together and should be performed, exhibited together. And it's, as far as I know, it's not happening anywhere else. This is something that I'm hoping it's going to bring a lot of people together. I hope that they'll come not only with the joy of being together, but also with a sense of kind of some solemnity about the occasion itself, because it isn't necessarily a joyful occasion. It is one that requires not just some solemnity, but some looking at this with judiciousness. Our chiefs did something really difficult in 1819, and it resulted actually in war and death, but it actually opened up Hawaii to a very different kind of future.
So this event coincides with 200 years since the Battle of Kuamo'o, in turn the fall of the Kapu system. How do you, in the modern context, reconcile the evolution of Hawaiian law in the modern day?
You know, one of the things that the Kapu was, the Aikapu, like the Chiefly Kapu, these were the laws. And making things sacred, setting things apart because they really belonged to what was divine, was the way in which society was ordered. In the same way that law orders society today, or in modern societies, the same way that written laws and legislatures and courts regulate society, the kapu, different kinds of kapu, regulated the society. But the kapu was also very personal. It was the ali'i and the ali'i nui, the great chiefs, the mo'i, who were able to set the kapu. This is divine, this is forbidden, this is sacred. And when they did that, it had to be obeyed. When it was not obeyed, the consequence was death. So one of the things that's really important is that when the Ali'i Nui that were Kamehameha's immediate heirs, Liholiho and Ka'ahumanu and Keopuolani, decided to break the eating kapu of men and women, they were risking their lives. They hoped that the other Ali'i would agree with them and not fight them over this. But they also knew that there was a very good chance that some would resist this breaking of this sacred trust and history and would fight. And, of course, that's actually what happened.
It's important that you bring up the solemnity of this event, not just as a momentous fundraiser, but the idea that there's a certain somber tone attached to it. The rule of law versus what is sacred has been at odds a lot. Does this event strike a particular poignancy because of that?
It absolutely does. And part of the reason for that is that the Hawaiian experience with law and with kapu, and the way we remember kapu, is that kapu was ultimately demanded full accountability of everyone. Maka'ainana and the Ali'i all had to obey the Aikapu, and if they didn't, they died. They were killed for it. We have become accustomed to a legal system in which there is rather little accountability. Rules can be broken, rules can be manipulated, all kinds of things could be changed. And you can look at the situation on Mauna Kea, you can look at the takeover of the Hawaiian government in 1893 as examples of where, despite our embrace of law as a people, in the 1840s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, despite our embrace of the law, those laws were simply tossed aside when people wanted to take over the government and when America wanted to assume control. In understanding that we gave up kapu in 1819, even though we didn't know what was coming next, these are some of the things that we want our people, and we want other people in the community, to think about. That sense of personal accountability, because while law is an important vessel for people who are oppressed and people who are poor, as something that allows them to stand and assert their rights before the powerful, you also need the accountability of leadership. And that was something we had under the Kapu that I believe we look for in vain in the 21st century.
Now, this event, obviously, it greatly benefits the student community, but how does enabling these students help the larger community as a whole?
For the longest time, Hawaiians have been sort of absent from the university, from its founding back in the early 20th century until really the 1990s. The numbers of Native Hawaiians who actually found their way into the University of Hawaii at Manoa were relatively small. When I was there in 1984, there were 8% of the campus were Native Hawaiians, and we were about 20% of the population. Our belief has always been, as we have built a Hawaiian curriculum and as we have built like Native Hawaiian student services to encourage, to recruit, and to retain Hawaiians in the academy, it's always been that the way to transform our own people from being hopeless wards of the state and having some kind of effect on how we are present in the criminal justice system. The surest way of doing this is through education. But along the way, we've also discovered that the knowledge of our ancestors, the knowledge that they created and that they transmitted through song, through works, through engineering feats, through things like the kapu, in which they learned how to care for the resources of ocean and land and guard them and keep them going even through difficult times, through flood and famine, that kind of knowledge is actually not irrelevant to a people who live in an island, even in the 21st century. The contributions, not just of these people, but of the knowledge they have and the fact that they are conversant not just in English sources, but in Native Hawaiian sources, and all those things that were written in the 19th century. It's one of the reasons why we believe the university is embracing the notion of a Hawaiian place of learning. It's not just as a toss-off to Native Hawaiians to encourage us to be here or some kind of guilting, you know, for all of the years that we have been ignored. It is actually an acknowledgement that we have something important to offer to knowledge and especially to how we frame education for the future of Hawaii.
Now, Hawaii Nui Akea is a very explicit place of learning, but we're seeing that other places of learning are coming about because of demonstrations seen across Hawaii, maybe not solely because of demonstrations, but definitely as a byproduct to it. Now, does Hawaiian knowledge, can it only be learned in these places of learning, or is it something that needs to happen on every level in society here, and does it need to be?
It needs to be happening on every level of society. When I went up to Pu'uhuluhulu and spoke to a gathering of Kanaka Maoli who had never been in a college classroom before and talked about these chiefs, talked about this particular date in our history, and talked about the issues around it, all I could sense from them was just this kind of awe that these stories even existed. We need to have a lot more community education, but much of that has been happening actually over the last century in hula halau among people who still practice old traditional sciences like lua. And what we're seeing now is the exchange of that knowledge and a strengthening of, yes, of Hawaiian studies, yes, of Hawaiian language, but also of a strengthening of students who are going in and finding careers teaching in sciences and social sciences and humanities as well.
It seems like we're going through something of a second Hawaiian Renaissance in terms of cultural preservation efforts. You were active in the original Hawaiian Renaissance, so how does the current moment compare to what Hawaii went through in the 70s?
Our young people know a lot more. So many more of them are fluent in the language than among people our age in the 1970s. They're not afraid. You know, in the 1970s, when we were rejecting the Navy's presence in Kaho'olawe or arguing for Hawaiian language to be taught and to be cherished, in some cases, we were fighting our own families over this. Families who had served in the Second World War in Korea and families who had grown up believing in the American way and the American dream. Families who had grown up with parents and grandparents who spoke Hawaiian but would not speak Hawaiian to them because it was not right for them to cling to that past. So you must move forward and you must speak English. And so they're looking at these young people like us who don't know these things but are wanting them. And we have to fight them over this. We have to argue with them. We have to do what we think is right even without their support. young people today who want to know what is fine and great and beautiful and intelligent about Hawaiian society and Hawaiian knowledge have the support of their elders.
That was John Osorio, Dean of Hawaii Nui Akea, the School of Hawaiian Knowledge at the University of Hawaii. He spoke with the Conversation's Harrison Patino about marking 200 years since the fall of the kapu system in Hawaii. A fundraising event called Ka Hulina Ao, The Changing Time, takes place this Sunday, November 10th, at Andrews Amphitheater at the UH Manoa campus.
There's a certain synergy that you get when you combine the best of the best, and that's just what the Honolulu Jazz All-Stars brings on Saturday, November 9th in HBR's Atherton Studios. West Coast-based guitarist Doug McDonald, who got his start in Hawaii, leads the group with jazz standards as well as some fresh and swingin' originals. Get your tickets now at hbrtickets.org, sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
One of the largest funders of the humanities based in Washington, D.C., has a broad reach out into the Pacific. Are the dollars being well spent? Well, the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities is in town visiting a long list of recipients. We sat down with John Parrish Petey, who's also in Honolulu for the 2019 National Humanities Conference.
The National Endowment for the Humanities is one of the two federal agencies that funds culture across the nation, the National Endowment for the Arts, our sister agency, and the National Endowment for the Humanities. And I've had the privilege of working at both of them. For the humanities, that means the funding of literature, of history. This means filmmakers such as Ken Burns. It also means museums and universities. And I'm happy to say that a number of the leading museums and universities we've funded have been in Hawaii. And to tell you where we are in terms of our budget is $155 million, and that is the largest budget in 10 years for the endowment. So we're happy about that, and I think that says that not only Congress, but the American public knows that we want to know about our nation. We want our school kids to be educated about our nation. And so what we do is we go across the country funding worthy projects at great institutions. We've funded large institutions or well-known institutions to your listeners, the Bishop Museum, for example, but also rather small groups. We were at the Manoa Heritage Center, and that was a great example of what a private citizen can do. And if somebody's saying, I want to tell the story of this island, I want to tell the story of Hawaiian culture. So our funding in Hawaii, to give you a sense of the scale of it, since 1965, our federal agency has awarded nearly $42 million in grants to Hawaii. And some of the more important examples I might note just in this immediate area is, for example, a very recent grant to the Bishop Museum. And this is to help them develop a master plan, a preservation plan for the largest Hawaiian and Pacific archaeology collections in the world. And this project is part of our long-term funding, and that long-term funding at the Bishop Museum equals $1.5 million. We're really, really proud of that. At the same time, we're also doing very small grants. Some institutions don't need that level of grant. So the Hawaii Mission Children's Society is a grantee, and of course the University of Hawaii at Manoa, for example, we've done a lot of funding there related to languages.
Well, you mentioned earlier, too, the Manoa Heritage Center, and I was just up there recently. We spotlighted what they do up there, and it is amazing as a center for teachers, for educators.
Absolutely. When we were there today, they had school kids there, and it was wonderful because they had a classroom, an open classroom. They could walk in and out with large sliding glass doors, but they could go out into the fields. They could go out and view archaeological work that was done hundreds of years ago and has been reconstructed. We could have a lot of conversations about what does ecological responsibility look like? What does sustainability look like? And that is a great example how expansive the humanities can be, that it's not just teaching one about world culture, it's also teaching someone about their own culture. So that was just a wonderful example of some of the work we've done here. And, you know, I mentioned the university earlier. I love two things about it. It's also working on language revitalization, preservation of languages, but also building on traditions about reintegration of warriors historically back into society. They're using some of these concepts for our returning military veterans of today. And I think that's a wonderful example of a catalytic federal investment and then the university stepping in with its own resources, its own expertise to create this important project.
So you're using these traditional values and kind of bringing it into modern day.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we've had teacher workshops here for a great deal of time, mostly with the East-West Center. But I was particularly happy to see what they're doing at the University of Hawaii for the current veterans.
Is there anything that, I don't know, that has just struck you as you, you know, go around, you know, visiting the various venues?
You've caught me on the start of my trip, and I'll have more to say after, you know, I've been here and I'll be touring for several days, and then I'll be on another island as well. But I think one thing I'm very much looking forward to is a look at our work at the palace and look at the development of the points of contact. And this project is to reinstall new permanent exhibitions.
Is this your first
trip?
No,
it's my second.
Your second trip, yeah. Okay.
So I first came to Hawaii about 40 years ago as a boy. My family was a family of six, and those family trips were the one time we're all together. We all had sports in different directions, and so sometimes they stand out in your memory differently. And so coming here to Hawaii was wonderful. It was emotionally powerful to see Pearl Harbor, the Arizona. I think my interest in military history was certainly brought alive in that experience. You know, I remember the very touristy things, you know, Don Ho serenaded my mother, you know, we're at the hotel and just the pleasure of being together as a family. But, you know, for every day to begin and end, you know, in the presence of the magnificent ocean, it spoke to me. It lingers in the mind.
Yeah, and we have such a rich history. You know, the monarchy was very modern for those times, traveling, you know, the world. And so it's just really neat when we've got these different projects by these nonprofits across the state working to preserve that history, the political history and the cultural history. You know, it puts it in perspective.
Absolutely. And that's where the Humanities Endowment can play, I think, a significant role, and also working with the State Humanities Council. And so the reason I'm here is this large convening of humanities leaders from across the nation. And it's not just being led by the Hawaii Council, but all the Pacific Islander councils. So Guam, Northern Marianas, American Samoa. So the four councils together coming and hosting leaders from across the country, that's, I think, a wonderful opportunity here as well.
We were talking earlier, you mentioned that you were doing some work with the Native Americans.
Yes. So an important part of what the endowment has done for decades is making sure that we include indigenous voices when we tell the story of our nation and our world. So on the mainland, that is Native American. We're also working with Alaska Native and also Native Hawaiian and other groups from the Pacific Islanders to make sure that the customs of these groups, the languages of these groups, are kept alive. And decades ago, even at the level of scholars, they would talk about language preservation. Now we're increasingly talking about language revitalization, which is to say to have multi-generational communication, storytelling, songs, whatever way it is that one conveys their culture forward with the voice. And so that's something I'm most excited about, I think, as a chairman, is to tell a more comprehensive story of not only these states and territories as they exist today, but the people that settled them, that built them, that in many ways gave the consciousness of the land. I'm somebody that's always drawn to nature. You know, I love woods and jungles and, you know, somewhat wild terrain. I'm looking at getting beyond, let's say, the urban core, and had a chance to do that a little bit today at the Manoah Center. You know, just getting to experience how the wind kicks up a light rain, and you can't quite see it in the sky, of course, and to know that that's just a few minutes outside, you know, the congested part of the city, you know, the urban part of the city. I love that. I love that somebody stopped and preserved it and said, this can be a place of teaching. This can be a place of knowledge. For me, I'm looking forward to getting to experience not just the cultural institutions of the state, but the terrain.
It must be pretty gratifying, though, as you go around to see, you know, what you've been able to fund and how it's been able to enhance the community.
Oh, absolutely. The endowment has made such a difference. And part of our goal is not simply to be the largest funder. That's not always a realistic goal, but to be the essential funder, to be the one who's there at the start of a project to say we believe in the promise of this endeavor. And so I think that's so important. To give even a modest grant that says to local leaders, this is something that has gone through the highest level of federal review, a level peer experts from across the nation, often from even from across the world, have said this is worthy of investment. And then when we give our funds, that says to local communities, to the state, to private and philanthropists, that this is something worthy.
And then you mentioned that we've got the highest funding that we've had in a long time, and there have been challenges along the way where folks have tried to, I think, cut the budget. But obviously something's gone right, or the fact that you have the support for the level of funding that we're enjoying right now.
Well, I think there's a real bipartisan support, nonpartisan support. I know certainly in Washington, we talk about politics a lot. I know it's on your airwaves, you know, and we're going into election. And I think it's important to know that not everything's entangled in that. And so both houses of Congress have voted for increases. The House of Representatives under the Democrats voted for increases, the Senate under the Republicans that have. Paul Ryan, when he was head of the House, when I became acting chairman, voted for an increase. It continued under Pelosi. So the idea that that some things are viewed by both parties, by both houses, as being beyond that battleground of mere politics. And what we're trying to do is to say to people, what kind of society do you want to live in? What kind of legacy do we want our young people to have? Do we want them to have the knowledge and the tools to access that knowledge? And the answer, I think, overwhelmingly is yes, we want that. And if we are to live up to the ideals of the founding, if we are to maintain a representative democracy, then we need someone, an agency, that says these are the best practices to be found wherever you may be.
Some things of value.
Absolutely.
That was John Parrish Petty, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, who is visiting from Washington, D.C. Following his time in Hawaii, he'll continue on to Guam and the Northern Marianas to meet with NEH grantees and other cultural representatives. Honolulu Civil Beats Reality Check today highlights the tug-of-war going on over a playground at Ala Moana Beach Park. Some people know it as the People's Park, or is it shaping up to be the Park Lane Condos Park? Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us to talk about a battle that's really heating up this month. Good morning, Chad.
Oh, good morning and happy Aloha Friday. Yeah, that's an understatement, isn't it, to say that this is heating up? But yes, and I should just tell our listeners that I'm reporting on Ian Lin's story that's up today on our website, something that Ian, who has his own blog, was reporting on earlier, and he's updated it. Basically, what he did is he followed the money. He looked into all the contributors to both Mayor Caldwell as well as the council members over the last few years to see whether there was any connect the dots with people involved with the Park Lane luxury condo and associated agencies around there. And sure enough, and now it's perfectly legal to make these donations. But I think for most folks, or a lot of folks, and certainly this was Ian's point, gee, it sure seems like that if you contribute to a politician, it seems to buy influence, seems to buy political clout. And that's what is raised in the story about this $3 million playground at Ala Moana.
Yes, I saw the mayor sent out a news release and with some pretty, you know, strong language. And I thought, gee, what brought that on? I hadn't realized that Ian had written something on his blog detailing all this. So it's good that this updates it.
Right. And of course, Denby Fawcett, one of our columnists, has been reporting on this, as well as the Star Advertiser and the TV stations. In a nutshell, the mayor said it was ludicrous, the criticism of the park that somehow the city and county of Honolulu is allowing rich people to build a playground, because that is the perception that is strongly suggested. We are talking about a nonprofit named Pa'ani Kako, which is a public-private partnership. They're gathering the funds to pay for this. The mayor did stress, look, this is actually a gift to the city and county, and at some point it will be turned over to the Parks and Recreation Department. The public is welcome to use the facility. It's not going to be gated off. The mayor said, look, we should be thanking these people. We should not be vilifying them.
Yeah, but there's this, I guess, lingering perception that maybe there's something else going on with this newly formed nonprofit.
Right. And remember that this Park Lane luxury condo is right there at Ala Moana Center. It's right across from the park, across Ala Moana Boulevard. And it sure looks funny when people like Duncan McNaughton, which, of course, is a big developer, McNaughton Corporation, and others who are connected to Park Lane, perhaps have residences there. And then when the mayor himself, going back to 2012, has, by Ian's count, $124,000 that has come his way from people linked to supporters of this park, it sure raises the eyebrows, if you will. I could use stronger language, but I'll just say it. It certainly raises eyebrows, and it makes it look like a quid pro quo.
And then also this week, there was an announcement out of Senator Brian Schatz's office about some federal funding that has just come up for Hawaii to build kind of a walkway over to...
It's actually... I'm glad you raised that, Catherine. It's a pedestrian bridge, is the way it's described, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. It's $20 million. And my understanding is this will be down towards Kiwalo Basin that would connect it to the Ward Villages area and to the planned rail stop, if the rail ever gets there. And that raises, you know, a question as well as somehow you're favoring these residents. I should also point out that what happened this week is that the council itself has strong reservations about whether this children's park should be built at Ala Moana. They passed a resolution saying, look, why don't you consider alternative locations like maybe the Kaka'ako area? Of course, there are parks there. There's a children's discovery center. A lot of the feedback that has been coming before the council, which passed this resolution, has been very negative, very suspicious about the park and who would ultimately be able to use it.
Right. And I know some of the opponents are saying, hey, if you put it at Kaka'ako, that might be good synergy there with the Discovery Center. You might get more of a draw, more activity, you know, fewer problems with the homeless camps moving in. And of course, the city just acquired that land over there in a transfer.
Oh, good point from the
HCDA.
HCDA, right, exactly. And so I think it does include the Kaka'ako Gateway Waterfront Park as well. We should also point out that a number of council members, ones currently on the council, ones that were recently on the council, also received a lot of money. I don't want to single out Mayor Caldwell, but thousands of dollars, according to Ian's research.
Well, I guess we'll have to see what transpires, or if we'll see some more more resistance if this project does get approved, and see how this plays out on the playground.
Very good, Catherine.
All right. Thanks so much, Chad.
Bye-bye.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read Ian Lynn's column on the playground tussle, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Can you keep a promise? Well, the state is hoping you will take a pledge to protect our coral reefs. The Division of Aquatic Resources is getting proactive as the warming temperatures continue to stress our vital marine environment. Brian Nielsen heads up the division. He talks about this latest push as a half-hour TV special about the pledge launches tonight.
So the idea of this coral pledge came about when we first were seeing the NOAA bleaching prediction maps for this year. They're predicting another major coral bleaching event heading towards Hawaii. So talking with our biologists at Division of Aquatic Resources, colleagues over at NOAA, Arizona State University, University of Hawaii, of what intervention methods are available, what can we do to help the corals during this time? And technology really hasn't caught up. There's nothing really available for us to reduce water temperature, shade corals at a massive scale. And so the best thing we could come up with is try to reduce any further stress to corals to help them through this tough time. And so that's where the Coral Pledge came about. So asking Hawaii residents and Hawaii tour operators to take this pledge of six easy actions to help save corals during these tough times.
Right. And even though I know we're hearing that maybe the bleaching event this year may not be as severe as we feared, it's still really important to get that messaging out.
Absolutely. And so it didn't turn out to be as bad as what we saw in 2015, but this is the third coral bleaching event, major coral bleaching event we've had in just 5 years, and each one is taking their toll. We're losing corals on each one of these events, and we don't have too many more of these events until we're not going to see much coral out on the reef. So we all need to really think about how we can do all we can to save corals.
I recall, being in the water and seeing the amount of reef that was just affected, and it was just so startling. Over in Lanikai, over on the on the west side of Oahu, and neighbor islands too.
Yeah, it is really sad. I've experienced the same thing where you get out on the reef, you see all the remnants of what used to be living coral that died during the 2015 event, and then you see new little corals that have managed to recruit back into those areas, starting to come back, and then seeing those corals now bleached. It's a really scary sight.
And so we do have some tools as well. I know we've done stories here about the coral card that you can go out and you can help get really good information by doing comparisons. I mean, if you do a grid on the reef, and identify, what are we seeing out there?
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're getting really good at monitoring these coral bleaching events, and there's been some great new innovations to bring, ocean users into the fold and help get their help in monitoring corals. So the Ko'a card that University of Hawaii developed is a great tool where you can go out with this card, compare it to the colors of bleached corals, and then report it to this really nice website and see where other people have found bleaching and really track the event. There's also the Eyes of the Reef Network, which is another great way for citizens to get involved. And then there's another new website called hawaiicoral.org, where if you see coral bleaching, you can just, one click of your phone and report that bleaching as well.
So it's really, it's being a citizen scientist, your eyes are out there, and you help to kind of create this body of data that that we can use.
Yeah, it's an extremely powerful tool. You know, managers, there's only so many of us to get out, but there's thousands of ocean users and many people that care about corals and have eyes on the reef and can really do a really great job of reporting what they're seeing out there.
So when you folks put this video together, you reached out to folks in the industry. You said the tour operators.
Yeah, we really wanted to get the message out about, you know, these six easy actions to help save corals. And we thought a great way to do that was to reach out to the tour industry that already have established education programs for visitors to Hawaii, you know, visitors that may not live near the ocean. They may not even know what a coral is. It's just a great outlet to really teach visitors how they can respect corals while they're here, enjoy them, but also know just some common practices of what they can do to let corals thrive and, you know, be around for the future.
So whether it's a dive group or a snorkeling group?
Yeah, dive groups, snorkeling groups, really reaching out to tour guides to have this as a part of, you know, what they educate their guests on. It's also really nice, too, considering we get around 10 million visitors a year, to really let the world know what Hawaii's seeing. You know, we're seeing the effects of climate change already through, you know, coral bleaching events, sea level rise, severe storm events. So it's another way to kind of get that message out that climate change is here. We really need to do something about it.
And we are, over at Hanama Bay, I know they've got the film that everybody's got to watch, and it's educational, and it's the hazards of the reef, I guess, to prepare people what they'll see in the water. But this then, I guess, goes a step further, and it's just you hope to get a broader reach out there.
Yeah. The film at Hanama Bay is a great way to educate visitors. But yeah, we're looking at a way to educate visitors that may not make it through Hanama Bay about what they can do to, you know, not step on corals or touch corals. They are living animals, so we want to give them their space. But also what Hawaii residents can do, you know, washing your car or fertilizing your lawn near storm drains that might make their way to the reef and impact water quality, messages like that we can all do.
Okay, and there's also the issue of our sunscreen.
Absolutely, that's one of the messages as well. Cover up as much as possible. Use reef-safe sunscreen to avoid, poor water quality around corals.
I know I used to like swimming early because I didn't like swimming in the middle of the day because everybody smells like coconut oil.
Yeah. Coming out of the water smelling like sunscreen is something that, yeah, I think we've all experienced in some of these, popular spots. But with the new legislation that was passed to, have reef-safe sunscreen, I think that's a good step forward.
So once these things debut then on TV, how else can people take a look at them, get eyes on them?
Yeah, so we also have the video on our website, on Division of Aquatic Resources website. They can also sign on to the pledge through our website. If you're a tour operator, there's a little form you can fill out. We'll send you education materials and sign you on to the pledge.
Is there anything that the state can do just to kind of highlight the companies that are doing good and doing right? I know NOAA has like the Dolphin Smart Program for those tour operators to make sure, you know, that you can see you're certified or you've pledged to keep your distance.
Yeah, absolutely. We do plan on putting the list of signees onto our website. And, you know, many operators have had outstanding conservation messages for years. So this is just another way to kind of show that they are giving back to the ocean and have been great stewards of our oceans.
Is anybody else doing this? Are we the only state or only entity or only island?
I know I was just in Palau. They've actually have a law that requires ocean stewardship and actions that visitors should take, what tour guides should take to promote responsible behavior. So I've heard about that program.
Right, the Palau Pledge.
The Palau Pledge. But I haven't heard about any any other states doing it. I know that there's some other programs being developed within Hawaii also coming out with some, you know, actions that people can take to be good ocean users that also include safety tips for staying safe in the ocean. So I think this idea is really gaining momentum.
And we have learned a lot from the molasses spill and from the damage that mariners often do to our reefs. But divers have been able to kind of right some of those coral heads that have been dislodged. So we've kind of, I guess, gained a body of knowledge as we've had these unfortunate mishaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Gained knowledge, and, you know, divers have been huge supporters of ocean conservation. We've got dive groups that go out. They clean marine debris off the reef. And, you know, we have divers interested in trying to get involved with reef restoration. So I think it's a great group that could really help help corals into the future.
That was Brian Nielsen with the Department of Land and Natural Resources talking about the state's new coral pledge. The show will be broadcast tonight on K5 and again on November 14th.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Haleakala Waldorf School and Honolulu Waldorf School.
Do you plan your Saturdays around this voice?
What's this American Life? Am I a glass?
If so, you won't want to miss this. For true This American Life fans, join HPR and Hawaii Theater Center for Ira Glass's one-man show on Saturday, December 21st. Members-only VIP packages include a pre-show reception. It's your chance to meet Ira Glass. Get tickets while they last at hprtickets.org, sponsored by Anthology Marketing Group.
Black Fire, White Fire is the name of a documentary film that we screen tomorrow in Kona. It's about a holy book, a Torah, and how it came to be in Hawaii. Our contributing reporter, Sherry Bracken, tells us more about this Hawaii connection.
It's really fascinating. I talked with Dr. Barry Blum. He's a longtime member of Kona Beth Shalom, which is the Jewish congregation on the west side of the Big Island of Hawaii that has this Torah, and with one of the filmmakers, Sarah Neely, who made the documentary with her filmmaking partner, Keith Neely. Now, everybody may know this, but the Torah is the sacred document of Judaism, and it contains the Jewish laws, the most well-known of which are the Ten Commandments, although Dr. Blum told me there are actually 613 Jewish commandments.
Wow.
So, yeah, I know. That's what I said, too. And, in fact, the 613th is that you shall write a Torah within your lifetime, and we'll get to the point where actually the members of Kona Beth Shalom have been able to do that. But the Torah is the first five books of any Bible, same books used by Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And what happened was Kona Beth Shalom in West Hawaii was founded around 1973, and the congregation had no formal Torah. They used like Xerox copies or something. And in 1985, the congregation applied to the Jewish Federation to receive an official kosher Torah scroll. Hmm. So they got a Torah that survived the Holocaust, and it was brought to Hawaii by a man named Mark Talisman, who was involved with the founding of the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. And this was so cool. It came in its own first-class seat on United Airlines. That's how important a document this is. And Dr. Blum told me that Senator Daniel K. Inouye even helped facilitate this, he being a big supporter of the Jewish people. So that's how it got to Kona.
So now, where did this Torah originate, though?
Well, Dr. Barry Blum is part of this documentary, Black Fire, White Fire, and he explained the origins of the Torah, what is called the Polna Torah.
There was a congregation in the southern part of Czechoslovakia, a city called Polna, and there was a Jewish community there. 250 to 350 years ago, probably some family was celebrating some wonderful event, and they decided to commission the writing of a Torah. It was brought to the synagogue in Polna and was used there regularly. In the 1930s, the Nazis began to do their terrible stuff, and they realized that any scroll that was left in a small community might be destroyed, so they sent a lot of their precious items to what they hoped would be safekeeping in Prague.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, I thought it was, and he went on to say that the items were stored in a warehouse, part of a synagogue in Prague that survived the war, but then it was pretty much forgotten.
So how did they find this Torah again?
Well, Dr. Blum told me, and it's in the documentary, and I find it really amazing. First of all, the synagogue and the warehouse in Prague survived World War II, and then the items just sat for 25 years in this warehouse. And so here's what he said about the warehouse in Prague.
At the end of the war, everybody forgot about it. It was uncovered in the 60s. And they found this treasure trove of over 1,000 scrolls. They were brought to a synagogue in London, Westminster Synagogue, where sofers restored them as best as they could.
Sofers are the scribes that work on Torah scrolls. That's what they do.
So now, if this is where the Kona Beth Shalom Torah came from. How did this documentary film come about?
Well, filmmaker Sarah Neely now lives in San Francisco, but she did live in Kona for a while. And her story of what inspired her to make this documentary is based on one of her first visits to Kona Beth Shalom to worship with the congregation.
We opened our prayer books. I had a slip of paper in my book. On the paper were names and a number. I think mine was Helena Rapova, 45. These were the people from Polna who were wiped out in the Holocaust, members of the congregation that prayed with this Torah, because there was no congregation remaining to say the memorial prayer, the Kaddish. One of the things that Kona Beth Shalom had taken on was remembering them. And I got chicken skin and tears.
So Sarah told me that the documentary talks about the Torah's origins, its initial restoration, and also its more recent restoration within the last several years when Kona Beth Shalom commissioned a sofer to restore it again. And since one of the Jewish commandments, as I mentioned, is to write a Torah in one's lifetime, or at least, in as Dr. Blum explained to me, it's really all you have to do is write a letter in a Torah. Members of the congregation were actually able to do that. And the way they do that is they don't actually allow ordinary people to write on the Torah. So the sofer holds the quill, the pen quill, old-fashioned, and the members can hold on to a feather while he actually does the writing. And even Governor Linda Lingle came to Kona, and she was able to write the letters Lamed, Lamed, or LL, in the Kona Beth Shalom Torahs.
I can see why Sarah Neely got chicken skin as I was, you know, listening to her recount that. Wow, what a connection.
It is a connection. And when she was telling me the story, it was like I was getting chicken skin and tears, because just the thought that you're holding a piece of paper that has the name of somebody who perished in the Holocaust, who was killed because she was Jewish. And this is how we're remembering them. Even as I'm talking to you, I'm kind of getting chicken skin, you know?
This is then, what, the first time that this film will be screened there on the Big Island?
It is. It is. Sarah Neely and her filmmaking partner, Keith Neely, made it, and it's going to be screened on Saturday, which is tomorrow, at a place called Pirateer's Cove, the old Hualalai Theater at the corner of Hualalai and Kuakini. It's the same complex for local people where Kaiser used to be. The events begin at 6. She's going to have a little poo-poo and champagne thing. And then the 45-minute documentary screens at 6:30. And then the filmmakers are going to talk, which will be super interesting. And Dr. Barry Blum is in the documentary. Kumu Keala Ching, who is featured in the documentary, will be there tomorrow night. And it's going to be a great event. And Sarah is not charging, but she does want reservations online, preferably at blackfirewhitefire.com.
I imagine the whole congregation will turn out for this. What a powerful film and powerful story.
Well, it is. And I imagine a lot of people will turn out. You know, I'm not Jewish, but I certainly want to go and see this, because even though they've told me the story, I'm really intrigued to see it. it is a really powerful, moving story. And here we are, Kona, on the Big Island, and we have a Torah scroll that is that old and that significant.
That's pretty cool. Now, you have to explain to me the title of this film, Black Fire, White Fire. What's that all about?
Oh, yeah. So this was interesting. Sarah said that the term refers to the letters. The black fire is the actual black letters written on the Torah scroll. And white fire is the spaces in between, representing the unknown, the unseen, the spiritual. And she said that revered Jewish leaders actually can interpret the white fire, the spaces between the letters. So again, another chicken skin kind of thing that, you know, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, I wish I could be over there on the Big Island to see it too. So hopefully there'll be more screenings.
I hope so. Sarah said that they're going to actually formally introduce this at some film festivals on the mainland. And then I do hope it comes back to the Big Island, because there's a lot of people who I think would be interested, you know, like, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. I think it's a fascinating story. And by the way, one more thing, Kona Beth Shalom does not own this Torah. It's on permanent loan from the museum in Prague, where it now permanently resides, the synagogue museum there. So, yeah.
Terrific story. Thanks so much, Sherry.
Thank you. Aloha.
Aloha. That was Hawaii Island reporter Sherry Bracken sharing the story about Kona Beth Shalom's Torah that survived the Holocaust and is now in Hawaii. Go to hawaiipublicradio.org for details of tomorrow's screening of Black Fire, White Fire. That's it for this week. Coming up next week, Fire and Fury. No, we're not talking about impeachment politics. We take a look behind the making of a book about Kilauea's destructive eruption. Veteran journalists at work. We would like to hear from you. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or just call us. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Harrison Patino, and Jason Ubai. The Backyard Quiz, thanks John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us Monday and pick up the conversation.